soldier from Golani Brigade in the southern city of Khan Yunis. He was killed on Thursday in an explosion that took place when mines intended to detonate for resistance operation detonated against him. The mines were reportedly intended to demolish buildings used by Palestinian resistance. Earlier, the military wing of Hamas released a video showing an attempt to capture another Israeli soldier who was later killed while trying to escape during the clashes in Gaza. According to the IOF, the death toll among Israeli forces in the Palestinian territory since October 2023 stands at around 900, with nearly 450 of them killed since the start of the regime ground invasion. However, many believe Israel undercounts its fatalities among its troops. Hamas has slammed the recent remarks by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which he ruled out the possibility of a comprehensive truce deal for Gaza. The movement said Netanyahu's remarks reflect his malicious and ill-intentioned efforts to block all deals that could lead to the release of Israeli captives and end to the Israeli regime's aggression against Gaza. Hamas added that it had a comprehensive proposal to release all captives at once in exchange for an end to the aggression, full withdrawal of Israeli forces, and the unrestricted flow of aid. Netanyahu, however, turned down that agreement. Hamas also condemned what it described as Netanyahu's attempt to derail the ceasefire process. The movement, however, affirmed its continued commitment to engage positively and responsibly in negotiations aimed at ending the war. Earlier, we spoke with political analyst William Jones about the outlook for ceasefire efforts in Gaza. Here's what he had to say.
Well, Netanyahu's program, obviously, is that ultimately he wants to have a greater Israel. He does not want a Palestinian state at all. Now, that's something that has never been accepted by the world. It is not something that has ever been accepted by the Israeli people over the last 50 years or so. Nevertheless, Netanyahu feels, to the extent that he still has the backing from the United States or the backing from President Trump in moving forward, that he can step by step move in the direction, first of all, of attaining entire control of Gaza. Now he's talking about limiting the Palestinian population to the south of Gaza, but he really wants the whole area. And if he moves in that direction, of course, is going to be the West Bank as well, which he intends to take under his wing. I don't think that will succeed because world opinion is still very strong, not as loud as one would want. You see that also the American population, which has been something of a sleeping giant in many respects with regard to the genocide in Palestine, they also will start to wake up. And I think at that point, this then becomes a different political reality that President Trump has to deal with.
Israeli forces have fatally shot two young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank after they carried out a retaliatory attack that left at least one Israeli soldier dead. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the men as Mahmoud Abed from Alul and Malik Salim from Brizia, northwest of Nablus. The two men were killed south of Bethlehem, and their bodies have since been seized by Israeli forces. The regime's military said the men carried out a combined shooting and stabbing attack near the Gosh Etzion settlement, killing one security officer and injuring at least four others, some in critical condition. The spokesman for Hamas military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigade, hailed the heroic operation against Israeli forces in the West Bank. Abu Ubaidah described the operation as a response to the aggression that has turned the lives of Palestinians into an unbearable hell. He called on Palestinian youth to escalate resistance throughout the West to stop Israel's plan for annexing the entire territory. And now to Yemen, where hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have once again rallied in the northern city of Saada to reaffirm their solidarity with Palestinians amid the genocide in Gaza. The demonstrators carried Yemeni and Palestinian flags, chanting slogans in condemnation of Israeli crimes in Gaza. They denounced the Tel Aviv regime's aggression against Yemen as well. The demonstrators also supported the Yemeni armed forces for their anti-Israel operation. Yemen have been holding pro-Palestine rallies almost every Friday since the beginning of the genocidal war on Gaza in 2023. And to Europe now, where Bosnia is marking the 13th anniversary of the Srebrenica genocide committed by Bosnian Serb forces, which is the deadliest mass killing in Europe since the Second World War. People are gathering at Srebrenica Memorial Center in the eastern Bosnian town to commemorate the genocide. In July 1995, more than 8,000 Muslims were executed and buried in mass graves after Bosnian Serb fighters overran Srebrenica during the final months of the inter-ethnic war in the Balkan country. Around 1,000 people also remain missing. The Srebrenica genocide is compared to the current genocide unfolding against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on Thursday that if the world had truly learned from Srebrenica, we will not be seeing another genocide against Muslims in Gaza. U.S. President Donald Trump presses ahead with his tariff war, announcing 35% levies on all imports from Canada. In a letter to the Canadian Prime Minister, Mark Carney, Trump said the tariffs will be put into force August the 1st. He pointed out that the new rate is in part caused by the flow of fentanyl from Canada, adding that it may go up if Ottawa retaliates. The 35% tariff is up from the current 25% that Trump imposed last year. In reaction to Trump's announcement, the Canadian Premier said his government will continue to defend Canadian workers and businesses in their negotiations with the U.S. Meanwhile, hundreds of people took to the streets in Sao Paulo on Thursday to protest against new tariffs on Brazilian goods announced by Trump.
This tax that Trump is imposing on Brazil is absolutely unacceptable. It goes against our constitution. He's interfering with our sovereignty. We cannot allow this.
It's just another one of his ridiculous stunts. He was going to take over the Panama Canal, he was going to take over Greenland, and he said he'd end all wars in 24 hours. And now he wants to slap a 50% tax on Brazil.
The Brazilian president has vowed to hit back against the U.S. imports with a similar 50% tariff announced by Trump. Earlier this week, Trump sent more than 20 letters to the leaders of other countries, including U.S. trade partners such as Japan and South Korea, outlining new tariffs on goods coming from those nations. I do have a guest joining us, Sakina Datto. Thank you so much for joining us, journalist, author, and producer, joining us from London to discuss that tariff with her. Sakina, we've seen this repeated move by Trump, not just now, even before, during his previous presidency, where he spoke about, you know, taxing the world and getting what U.S. deserve. But we're beginning to see this tariff affect even U.S. trade partners and even military alliance that the U.S. has formed around the world. How do you think this trade war is going to pan out as it concerns U.S. domination of economical aspects of the world and also its military, dominance that it has around the world as well?
I think, you know, it signals to me a bit of a desperation from Donald Trump, both on economic front but also political front. So on economic front, I think, you know, as somebody who comes from the background of the business world, he sees the economy of America getting weaker, you know, by day. And he's coming up with these measures to try and boost the economy, but a lot of economists actually predict that it's going to do the opposite. It's going to cause inflation, you know, it's going to affect the local farmers' production within the U.S., and also the partners like Canada, Mexico, his neighbors. And of course, then there is also the political aspect of it. We recently saw him talking about imposing this tariff on anyone who is willing, who wants to be part of BRICS countries. Mm. Now, this is a political move because, of course, you know, the U.S. has enjoyed hegemony in the global, arena for a very long time. And the challenge that is coming from BRIC countries is a huge one for America and its, partners. So he's trying to ensure that he uses force and uses threats to dispel or any attempt by BRIC countries to share this hegemony.
Do you think it will succeed? Sorry for interrupting. Do you think that plan would succeed? Because we do see that, people, businesses don't trust. If you can no longer trust your business partners, how are you supposed to keep on having business agreements with them?
Not only has trust been eroded, which obviously will not make this worse, but also, Donald Trump by himself, the kind of person he is, we have seen how many times he puts up these tariffs and then goes back on his words and removes them and then starts them again. So really the trust factor is very, very low at this stage. But also, mind you, the world has changed. There was a time when U.S. could dish out threats to the world and people used to be scared on every front, whether you're talking economic or you're talking politically. The world is now starting to realize that, we can't give in to this bully and we will stand up to them. And so you have seen a lot of BRIC countries saying that, whatever the U.S. says, we are going to stay on course and therefore we are not going to be scared of these, supposed tariffs coming in. And I actually don't think they will work. It is just a threat, because if they were to be implemented, they are going to affect more the U.S. economy than anywhere else. I think this is just a showman, like everything else Donald Trump does. This is just words. And I think very soon he will realize that this is not workable. It is going to cause, global inflation, but more so it's going to affect the Americans more than anyone. Already their economy is hugely affected. There is huge deficit. And I think he will only succeed in making that worse.
Well, those who support Trump will argue against that, but we will be keeping our eye on that story. That is Sekina Dato, journalist and producer, joining us from London. Thank you so much. And that does bring us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you so much for joining us. Goodbye for now.
Tired hands to the sky. Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
How do we teach brotherhood to the children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, a beautiful yet a very important topic in the religion of Islam, because the first thing what I'm going to say is about the importance of ukhuwa, or brotherhood itself. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam, we see them practicing brotherhood everywhere.
Yeah.
Because it brings unity amongst people. Okay. One of the reasons, of course. So we see aqde ukhuwa, the deal of brotherhood, which the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, amongst the first things which he has done after he came to Medina, in which he himself declared that he is the brother of Amirul Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, which is so beautiful though. So going ahead, of course the Quran itself says the believer are the brothers to one another. This is there, and there's a hadith from Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, shake hands with your brother because it will remove away, it will bring peace and it will remove the sins between you. Whatever sins are there, they're going to be removed because of just a handshake.
Wow.
You see, like this warmth, this brotherhood itself, like example, if you tell your child, okay, you know what, go and make friends with the other child, okay? You know that the other child is a good person or a good child, has good manners and stuff.
Impact on your child.
So, you know, and you know what? Recently, in the month of Ramadan, it happened that I saw a brother who was teaching his daughter, who was like about 6 years or something, and he was saying, and it was very beautiful. It was an eye-catching for me. He was saying his daughter, do you know who she is? Then his daughter was like, no, I don't know. Then
I have no idea.
It's the first time I'm meeting her. Then this brother asked that girl, in front of his daughter. He was like, do you love Bibi Fatima al-Zahra? Salamullah alayha. And the girl was like, yes, I love Bibi Fatima al-Zahra. And he asked his daughter, do you love Bibi Fatima al-Zahra? And she was like, yes, I love Sayyida Fatima, salamullah alayha. And do you love Imam Ali? Yeah. And he asked the same question. So you both have something in common. Then why don't you become friends?
Yeah.
And go and sit beside her. You see?
Okay.
So it was something very beautiful. I was like, wow. Like, you are making friends just like that.
Mm-hmm.
This is like ukhuwa, like a kind of brotherhood, a sisterlyhood amongst the believers.
Yeah.
Which is very important.
Especially in today's world.
In today's world. Yes, of course. Indeed. Yeah. So there's a lot of emphasis from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam on this particular topic of ukhuwa, which they, just like I've stated, like what Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasalam has done.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to siblings, especially, this becomes more dense and it becomes more eye-catching. It's not just with the believers that they are brothers. Example, they are siblings, even they are brothers. Like, yeah. of course, from one blood, I would say. Yeah?
Yes.
The brotherhood should be the strongest over here. And what a parent can do acts a very important role. It is a, like, it is more eye-catching. It is more important for the parent to see towards his own children, like how he is managing brotherhood between them.
Right. It, now it's becoming more interesting because from natural brotherhood to from others, like from the society to your own siblings. Let's ponder on that, just reflect on that, and we'll take a short break.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him most day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman, don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here, and we are discussing the importance of teaching brotherhood to your children. So mostly things are taught to children, not by saying, not by lecturing, but by action.
Mm-hmm.
So when you yourself are an isolated person and you expect your child to be a social person, to have that brotherlyhoodness with others, maybe the results are not going to be as you expect. Because yes, mostly the children learn from actions.
Yes, definitely. So example, if it is your own children, there are two, be it a brother or sister, or brother or sister, doesn't matter over here. Instilling the sense of brotherhood is very important. Instilling the love of brotherhood, the fact that we are siblings, is very important amongst them.
Yeah.
And if they fight by any chance, which is normally common, it doesn't mean that, oh, they hate each other.
Yeah.
It is very important how you intervene amongst them, that the brotherhood amongst them is not spoiled. Mm-hmm. Example, if I give preference to one child over the other, their brotherhood might get affected. Yeah, might get degraded, I would say. Or example, if you give a gift to one of them and you don't give a gift to the other, again, there's a problem. Example, if you praise one and you don't praise the other, there's a problem. If you kiss one and you don't kiss the other, there's a problem. You see, their brotherhood is going to get affected. So, in order for you to instill brotherhood, there are don'ts as well. There are do's
and there are don'ts.
So, you have to focus on both of them. You can't be like, oh, you know what? It's like they're going to play and I'm going to give them toys and I'm going to like make them go to this place and that place and it's done. Yeah. I have done my responsibility. No, it's okay. You're doing for them. But there are don'ts which you have to stop yourself from as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So example, one of the do's. Now I'm going to the do's. Okay. Example, what you can do is giving gifts to both of them or a better manner. You give a gift to both of them, that's definitely important, okay? Because as a relationship of a parent and a child.
Yeah.
But they themselves giving gifts to each other is also important.
Oh,
so that the brotherhood is made strong, like is made stronger. There's a lot of impact amongst themselves. Example.
You remind me of my children.
Okay.
I gave pocket money to the elder one.
Uh-huh.
I have two sons, so I gave pocket money to the elder one, and he saved some money, and he brought an ice cream for the younger one when he came back from the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was getting back the younger one from the school, and he was very hungry, like coming back from the school, and I brought his favorite thing for him mm-hmm. from the market. He so much wanted me to open it, and then he stopped me opening it. And I was like, why? He said, like, you know why?
my brother, after coming from school, brought me something that I like, and I also want to take something for him. I was really amazed on this thing, like seeing what he got without us teaching them this.
Yes.
I was really amazing to see under five child saying that.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You see, it's through the action of his elder brother that the younger one has learned
this.
Yeah,
exactly. So there's a lot to ponder on. There's a lot to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And inshallah, may Allah increase this brotherhood among the mu'mineen. We'll take a short break here and we'll be back in a while.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and Brother Liaquat Abbas is here. And we're discussing the importance of teaching brotherhood to your children.
Yep. So, example, what you can do is if the child is not sharing toys with his sibling, his brother or sister, what you can do is you can make a pact between them, a funny pact. And you can say, okay, now you're going to promise, like, I'm going to share my toys, just like Imam Hussain alayhi salam used to share his things with Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam. Example, you see the concept of Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam, because
Introducing them at the same time.
Mm-hmm, yeah, because they used to share with one another, you are going to share your toys as well with your siblings. Example, so this is one of the methodologies where you can teach to share. You know, one thing is, when the sense of brotherliness and the sense of this brotherhood becomes strong, the moment the elder one, that is the father, example, passes away, the child become, they get this sense of parenthood. Example, there's a hadith where it is said the elder brother acts as a father in the absence of a father. Like if the father passes away, the elder brother kind of becomes a father for the younger child, okay?
Yeah.
So for that thing to happen, a strong brotherhood should be there between them both.
Yeah.
That this is going to happen, yeah?
Yeah.
So coming back to this Islamic brotherhood topic, the lines of conclusion, I would say, is that never ever, never ever drop hatred between your children. Example, don't say, oh, you know what? It is your brother who has done this. Or it is your sister who has done this thing to you. Or example, yeah, definitely they have done something bad to your child.
But this is the worst thing you could do ever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you are making things worse, yeah? Instead of sorting it out, instead of winding things up between them and making them again back to normal life,
you're
making it worse. So never do this.
Yeah.
And when you bring a gift, make sure you bring gifts for them both as well, so that they exchange it between themselves. When you praise one, you praise the other.
Yeah.
And teach them to praise each other. Teach them to show love and affection towards each other.
Yeah. And that brings us to the end of another heartfelt session on Islamic upbringing. I want to thank Brother Liaquat Abbas for his valuable contributions, and all of you for being a part of this beautiful community of listeners. Let's keep striving in our homes, in our hearts, to raise a generation grounded in faith, kindness, and emotional strength. May Allah guide us all and reward every sincere effort you make as a parent or a mentor. Until next time, this is Zainab, signing off with love and du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Professor Jeffrey Sachs joins us now. Professor Sachs, a pleasure, my dear friend.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you at some length about the collaboration, you can call it a plot if you want, between Israel and the United States against Iran. But before we do, can we lay to rest what the president has been saying as recently as yesterday, Sunday, on Fox Business, where he boasted once again that his bombs, and he used that phrase, totally obliterated the nuclear capabilities of Iran. Is this true or isn't it true?
No, it's plainly false. It is absolutely false. Iran did not sit around with its enriched uranium waiting for this to happen. It almost surely secreted it out to other sites. There is simply no way that a firm conclusion can be reached that this ended Iran's nuclear capacities. It did not. Now, I think it's also important to say that Iran has made perfectly clear for 20 years, and I had discussions today with a senior Iranian diplomat, they don't want atomic bombs. They don't want the burdens of them. They do not want to make themselves a target of nuclear war in that way. They do not want them, but they do not want to be overthrown by Israel's murderous government. And that is a problem. And last week was an attempt by the Israeli government, which is a rogue state, the most dangerous on the entire planet, to kill the Iranian leadership. Not only the supreme leader, but government officials as well. They succeeded in many murders, but they did not succeed in the regime change operation. Then came this U.S. bombing of these sites. It did not change anything, in my view, in the nuclear calculation, but it made everything far worse in terms of the potential. When I say didn't change anything, it didn't change anything in terms of Iran's capacity to produce atomic bombs, or, by the way, to obtain them from others. All it did was make the situation far more dangerous, because now there is no inspection taking place. The Iranians know without question that they were targeted in a very deadly regime change operation. They know that the United States was party to it. They know that European countries are basically vassal states of the United States, so won't say one word on their own. So they know that they were targeted for assassinations and regime change. That does not make the situation safer today than last week. It makes everything far more reckless and dangerous.
So I guess the answer is also no when President Trump boasts, as he did as recently as last night, that Iran was, quote, weeks away, close quote. Secretary Hegseth has said the same thing, from developing a bomb. There is no basis for that. It's just political claptrap.
If Iran wanted to make a mad dash for a bomb, it could have done so in the past. There is, as I think everybody now understands, a religious ruling many years ago that Iran does not want a bomb. There were negotiations for years where Iran said, we give over our nuclear materials, we open ourselves up to inspection, we do not want a bomb. We do not want unilateral disarmament because Israelis will murder us, period. So they don't want to be murdered by Netanyahu and his gangsters. But on the other hand, they don't want a bomb, even though Israel, of course, has many nuclear weapons. If there's a rogue state in terms of atomic weapons, it's, of course, Israel.
Why is there no conversation about that? Why is there no national in the U.S. or international conversation about how Israel, without signing the non-proliferation treaty, without permitting any inspections, and on the basis of stolen information, has a nuclear weapon, but Iran's not permitted to have one? What kind of justice is that?
And not only does Israel have nuclear weapons, it's not only and also not part of the non-proliferation treaty, but of course there's no international verification or inspection of anything that Israel does. There is discussion all over the world, just not in the United States and its vassal states in Europe and in Israel. So this is a game. It's the ultimate double standard, but that's part of the point of empire, by the way. The American policy is not to pretend that there is a consistent line. The Americans and the Israelis in their way want to say, there are rules. The rules apply to you. We do anything we want and don't forget it. And that's not hidden. That's part of the whole idea. That is, we will kill you if you don't follow our rules. And we mean it. We don't have to follow them. We don't have to have international standards, but we have the rules. That's the so-called rules-based order. It means America sets the rules for others, not for itself. So there is discussion all over the world, but in the United States, there is not. And that comes back to our domestic politics. It comes back to the Zionist hold on American politics, which, remember, is as much or more a Christian evangelical movement as it is a Jewish movement. The Jewish community is more divided on this point than the Christian evangelicals, who vastly outnumber the Jews in terms of voting power and in terms of Trump's base. But there's a lot of money that is invested in making sure that the Congress of the United States is 100% subservient, and that whoever occupies the White House understands that their job is to do what Israel says.
Which country had the better outcome from the 12-day war, Iran or Israel?
Israel suffered massive losses, many direct hits in Haifa, in Beersheba, in Tel Aviv, the Iron Dome, and the other parts of the system, because that's just one component of Israel's air defense system, failed on multiple occasions. Iran has missiles that can penetrate Israel's air defenses, and Israel got hit hard, but it could have and could be in the future hit far harder. So Israel suffered a lot. Israel has no impunity in this and will get hit harder and harder each time this is done. Israel may have told, according to some stories, I have no idea whether it's true, may have assured Trump, don't worry, it's a 24-hour operation. We murder the whole top of the government. We have a new government in place shortly. All will go well. That obviously did not happen at all, nor did the defenses work the way that the Israeli censors want us to believe. There was direct military censorship from Israel after the second or third day. We did not see all of the damage, but people posted a lot of the damage, and we know that it was extensive, and very, very real, and very dangerous for Israel. But this is also just to say that Israel's been making wars for 30 years and drawing the United States into wars for 30 years that has not improved Israel's security. This is the irony. Same with the United States. We could be the most secure country in the history of the world, and yet we're closer to nuclear Armageddon than ever because of our flagrant, blatant irresponsibility of pushing us closer to the brink because we do not play fairly at all. We cheat on everything, every day. Every day is a lie, and every day threatens to push us to the nuclear brink, whether it's with Russia or with many other countries that have nuclear weapons right now. It's the only risk we face, but we're not behaving the president and the deep state in a way which actually protects us, though we should be the safest people in the whole world. But we're absolutely, as the atomic scientists tell us in their doomsday clock, we're the closest to nuclear war and the closest to self-destruction since the start of the nuclear age. We're just blowing it because we cannot seem to understand basic facts of how to have stable, honest, truthful, peaceful relations with other countries.
What did the United States gain by Trump's dropping of these bunker busters?
I think they wanted to try out these bombs. They want to look tough. Trump said it was the greatest bombing in the history of the world, or he compared it to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which itself is an amazing thing for any president to say, especially if one happens to know the history of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because the history is not as every school child has been told for the last 80 years, that it saved American lives from invading Japan at the end of World War II. That's the bunkum story. The true story is that Japan was begging to surrender. It wanted to keep the emperor. The United States said, we're going to drop the bombs first, because Truman wanted to make a big show to Stalin, mostly. It did not save any American lives, because in the end, the United States said, yes, the emperor stays anyway. Neither of those bombs needed to be dropped. But I make the point that Trump just, he said, no, I shouldn't make that comparison. But then he made the comparison. That's not an accident. He's bloviating. He wants to say, look at how powerful the United States is. We can do what we want. We can blow you up. So that's what he thinks he gained. But in fact, it doesn't work this way in actuality. The United States can't do what it wants. A lot of the world understands that very, very well. The more we have this bloviating, the less the United States is able to enter into any kind of serious agreement with any other country on any substantive issue. This is extremely hazardous for the American people to have a political system that is completely untrusted and untrustworthy by others.
I'm going to ask you in a minute about the nature and extent of American and Israeli collaboration against Iran. But before I do, I want you to watch a rather extraordinary video of David Barnea, you know who he is, the head of Mossad, thanking the CIA and the CIA director for all of its help. I don't know why this fellow allowed himself to be videoed doing this, unless he plans on running against Netanyahu for prime minister, but that's another topic for another time. Chris, cut number six.
I also want to express appreciation and gratitude to our main partner, the CIA, for the joint operations and the missions that were carried out, and also to the head of the CIA, who supported the Mossad in making the right decisions, which ultimately made this operation possible. We will continue to keep a very close watch on all the projects in Iran, which we know in the most thorough way, and we will be there just as we have been until now. But we must not forget that there are still 50 hostages in the Gaza Strip, 30 deceased, 20 living hostages, whom it is our moral and ethical duty to bring back to our border. I want to thank you all again, and to tell you that you are part of history, an unforgettable and inseparable part of what the Mossad has done and continues to do. Continue working shoulder to shoulder with our partners in the IDF and the Shin Bet, and in this way, we will keep bringing great achievements to the people of Israel. So thank you all very much. Well done, truly well done.
What do you make of that?
First of all, 25 hostages, and they're killing 50 to 100 innocent Palestinians every day. They're killing 50 to 100 innocent Palestinians every day by luring them to food sites and then shooting them deliberately. And we know this from testimony of IDF soldiers in recent days, carried in stories in Israeli media. They're mass murdering the Palestinians before our eyes. And this man talks about the moral and ethical responsibility. This man is a mass murderer. That's Mossad's job. Now, Mossad and the CIA have a very strong relationship. They are closely allied in many operations around the world, especially in the Middle East, but in other regions as well. And that is a very key part of American foreign policy and a very key part of the U.S.-Israel relationship. The Mossad-CIA connection goes back at least more than 60 years, we know. It's very strong, and I always emphasize it is the CIA where you find our foreign policy, not the White House especially. The CIA is the deep state. It keeps the long-term strategy, whether it's to try to weaken or overthrow governments in Russia or Iran or other places. It was the lead agency in a long war against the Syrian government that took hundreds of thousands of lives and culminated in a jihadist regime coming to power, which suddenly we declared to be our wonderful friend and ally, because in fact we run jihadists, the CIA does, and so does Mossad, contrary to what casual thought would suggest. So I'm not surprised by it, other than how clearly stated all of this is. That is just a long, professional, deadly, horrible relationship. Horrible because it has made a 4,000-kilometer swath of violence across North Africa, the Horn of Africa, the Eastern Mediterranean, and West Asia, running from Libya to Iran. This is murder incorporated, and murder, whether it's of the leaders for overthrows of government or mass murders of Palestinians, does not solve anything other than making mayhem and murder.
Is it realistic to fear that Trump will use nuclear weapons next time around?
I don't think so. I really doubt that. I think that, as I say, the United States has no security risk in the world other than a nuclear war. And I think that this is really understood by a lot of people who still make wars who still say, oh, we're threatened by this, we're threatened by that, we're threatened by global terrorism. Remember the war on global terror and how Americans were terrorized by all of this, which was never a threat in the way that it was described. I don't believe that we're anywhere close to having a nuclear war over this. But if you push other nuclear powers like Russia or North Korea or Pakistan, you could certainly provoke a nuclear war. That is absolutely, or China, obviously, I should mention, over Taiwan, another phony issue that would never be the issue it is were it not for the provocative American positions on this. Because if it weren't for America arming Taiwan, Taiwanese politicians would never do the provocative things that they are actually doing, many of them, which bring us closer to a direct confrontation between the U.S. and China. In other words, I don't believe that this is leading to America's first use of a nuclear weapon, but I do believe it is leading us to the real possibility of a nuclear war that completely becomes a global annihilation. That, I think, is the real point I'm trying to make, which is that our foreign policy is so erratic, so irresponsible, so devoid of true international principles, so filled with a lot of BS, that that's what makes it very dangerous for us.
Would Netanyahu, is he crazy enough to use nuclear weapons against Iran?
Under certain circumstances, yes. That if Israel was threatened by a massive attack by Iran that followed an attack by Israel, then yes, that's absolutely possible. And that's one of the things that could trigger a global nuclear war. And Netanyahu absolutely would. That's why Israel has them. And Israel thinks it can provoke any side. It has pretended that its Iron Dome and other air defense systems give an absolute protection to Israel. Now we see that this is completely false. And so if Israel provokes another attack and there's a massive attack from Iran that is threatening the heart of Israel, and one can imagine many ways that that could happen, then I have no doubt that Israel would contemplate the use of one or more of its nuclear weapons. So any state threatened with survival that has nuclear weapons would do so. This is definitely true of Israel, given this mentality that is there, which is stoking up dangers because it refuses to have any kind of real diplomacy with the Arab world over the core issue that has been the core issue for 100 years, and that is the right of Palestinians that also live in the same area as Israel and that Israel is occupying. And because of that, the violence continues to soar. Israel provokes. It is not in a strong position the way that it thinks it is, and last week exposed its vulnerabilities. It counts on the United States to rescue it, but we can see that the United States may say, no, don't do that. The Israel provokes, believing that the U.S. will follow. The U.S. doesn't follow. Mass response from Iranian side, and then Israel feels that its survival is a threat, and it uses a nuclear weapon, after which there could be many scenarios of Pakistan defending Iran or North Korea or many other things that one could imagine that could then lead on to a nuclear war that would rapidly get out of hand and destroy the world. That's why every single thing that we're doing in all of this is so unbelievably dangerous and reckless. It's hard to put into words without profanity, sorry to say. And while the president uses profanity, we're not going to use profanity the same way. And the fact of the matter is, we need diplomacy. We need diplomacy to end the war in Ukraine. We need diplomacy to end a potential conflict over Taiwan. And we need diplomacy to create a state of Palestine alongside the state of Israel and to end Israel's wars of regime change. Because these are the conflicts that could destroy the world, not in one step, but in one step with escalation, with retaliation, with the pressing one side to use a nuclear weapon, leading to a nuclear exchange, leading to a rapid escalation that ends the world. And there is a book that I may have mentioned in our past discussions, but I recommend it to anybody that wants a chilling and accurate account of how the world could come to an end in 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's called Nuclear War, a Scenario, by the investigative journalist Annie Jacobson. It's a superb, accurate, technical, chilling account of what I'm describing, which could happen in any of these war zones, which is why we need diplomacy, not games, not regime change operations, not Lindsey Graham, our most dangerous and reckless senator, posts game on as Israel strikes and the United States strikes Iran. Game on. This is not a game.
Professor Sachs, thank you very much. Thank you for your analysis, as painful as a lot of this is. Truly, truly and profoundly appreciated. Thank you for staying up for us. All the best.
Of course. Again,
friend. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Allah, Allah.